Hello.
Hello.
Hi, everybody.
Hi, hello. Can
Hello.
you hear me?
Yes, indeed. So
Okay. Do we have three in Germany and three in the North America, I guess?
I'll be in Germany in 2 weeks.
2 weeks,
Well, I'll
okay.
be in Germany on Tuesday. I'll be with you in Germany, I hope, in 2 weeks.
Where will you go?
I'll be in Munich.
Berlin?
I'll be in Munich and Austria and the Czech Republic for 3 weeks, then Scotland for 3 weeks, then Berlin for 3 weeks.
Wow.
When will you be in Munich? But it
Wednesday.
ah ah
Wednesday.
but for your stuff or because you are meeting people, Albion people?
Yes, no, yes and yes.
Ah, okay. It's your private for your private trip.
So it's a mixed bag. It's different things. Yeah.
Is there also a center? Sriobindo Center in Munich?
Not
I
that I
don't.
know.
I don't know. In fact, I never heard of that. Okay.
Not that I know of. There are friends in Munich, though.
Your friends, yeah.
Yeah, but there's Aurevilians there for sure.
Yes, sure. But because as far as I know, maybe Tony can correct me. The only group that is active in Germany is in Berlin, and then there is a group near Darmstadt. I don't remember exactly where it is, of the Sriobindo Society. Then there's, as far as I know, there's nothing else. But just to check if there's something else, just wanted to know.
The president of ABI Germany is in Hamburg.
Okay, but is there a group that organizes something that where people can meet?
I don't know. Yeah, I can find out for you though.
Yeah, thank you. Would be very nice. Thank
Where are you, Marco?
it is in, it's called Haßfurt. It is very little town between Nuremberg and Würzburg. 100 kilometers from Nuremberg. How do you say in English?
Nuremberg.
Nuremberg, yeah. Nobody knows. Even Germans don't know where it is.
But that would be the site of the trials after World War II, right?
Yeah, no, yeah, but I'm living, as I said, about 100 kilometers from there. So that's 80 miles, 70 miles. But I
It's in
say
Bavaria.
Nuremberg. Yeah, it's still Bavaria. It is in northern Bavaria. It's near Würzburg. Not so far, or between Würzburg and Schweinfurt. I am in the middle there. It's called Haßfurt. Nobody knows, but it's a very nice place. Lots of woods. I like it.
You know, I haven't looked around with this out of window stuff. I've Googled a little bit, but I really just want to read the book and maybe afterwards get in contact with some people. But I'm really just focused on reading. And we are meeting here, so that's something. That's
You're meeting there. Ah,
no, we
okay.
are meeting here right now, so that's my out
Ah,
of window group.
Yes, because in fact that's nice, but it would be also nice to form a group physically. If you know someone in Germany, in Bavaria, maybe could be interesting.
Yes.
Let me know in case.
Yes. Munich, maybe.
Yeah, it would be still far away from it, still 300 kilometers, but still nearer than United States, yes, of course.
Yes. Yes. I tried to summarize two chapters, right? So chapter 15 and 16, and it took me about 6 days, so 3 days for one chapter. And Marco, you said something that it is a lot of work, right? It is really a difficult text, and it is a lot of work. And I think that if you would like to do it deeply, I mean, 1 week for two chapters is probably not enough.
Yeah. Yes. Okay. That personally, at least for me, I saw, well, maybe there's also a sort of laziness. It's like a homework for school. And when you take it with that, it is a wrong way of taking it, I think, because then I have had the tendency to read it in the last, because it is the third time that I read in Life Divine. So in a certain sense, I say, okay, well, I already know, but that's not true. Because every time that I read it again, I find always lots of new things and new perspectives that I didn't consider and didn't perceive in the previous reading. But I think it's, you know, ideally, I know that it is not practically possible. Ideally, one should read a paragraph and then ask question, comments. Read another paragraph, questions, comments. So, okay, then it would take probably 5 years until we would go through it. I don't know. But that would be perhaps the ideal thing to do. Because two chapters in once, and then there are a lot of points and a lot of things that remain open question. And when you come at the end, you reach the end, at least that's my, for me, maybe not for everyone, but then there are a lot of open questions that you tend also to forget. But okay. Yes,
because it's so dense, it's so much material.
It's a lot of stuff. But I understand there are practical reasons also, these sessions cannot become infinite. Also, if it's called infinite conversations, I understand that we have to give some rules.
You know, we have a trouble in the theater, like when they want to do Hamlet, because actually the full play is about 5 hours long. But because most people have an 8 o'clock curtain and they have to be at home by 11 o'clock so they can go to work the next day, that never happens. So yeah. There's tremendous frustration chopping up this great play into manageable bits and still keeping a coherent narrative. Mm-hmm. I appreciate the close reading would be the ideal. And if we were all living in an ashram and had unlimited time and didn't have to work, I think it would be a great way of doing it. But I guess it's a miracle that we have this technology and we can do the best that we can with what we have.
Well, I'm certainly thinking about this since I've set myself up to do the next week's exercise. So. But I have reserved some time for it. So,
you know, I heard once of a group who read one page of Finnegan's Wake for one session, and one page for every session. So that's the extreme. But I think you know, two chapters per week, that's probably a little bit too much. But I mean, people can do it however they want to do it, and you can just rush through. And I mean, I'm interested what comes out and what other people find in him and find in the text.
Hmm. is because it totals, I think, the 55, 56 chapters. And if you make a chapter per week, it means 1 year, a little bit more, as or 1 year and a quarter. So could be also in principle.
Are we going to have a meditation before we start, or have we started already?
We haven't started.
Okay, well, so, it's about 10 after, 11 after. Maybe we should go.
Okay, then let's start. I should lead the session. I obviously won't lead the discussion. I will facilitate a discussion. I will facilitate people having a conversation, hopefully, about this. And I will do the introduction, and I will do it the way that Marco has suggested it. He said we should split it up. So there are two chapters, chapter 15 and chapter 16. And, you know, I will do the introduction to chapter 15, and we discuss it for an hour. And then I will do the introduction to chapter 16, and we will discuss that for an hour. And this is how we will do it. So, and we will do this meditation, and then I will read the introduction, and then, you know, we just talk about chapter 15. And I think, who was it? John Davis. He made this little exercise with people, you know, visualizing whatever comes to mind when they read the text, you know. What I wanted to do is just for people who have read those two chapters to visualize, you know, planet Earth, which is, I think, a much more potent religious symbol. Like, it's the religious symbol of the 21st century. It's the picture of the planet, the whole planet from outside, is something that people 2000 years ago and even Aurobindo probably didn't have in 1914, 1908, by the time he wrote the book. He didn't have the picture of the Earth from outside. So that's, in a sense, something very special. And what I find fascinating about this picture of seeing the Earth from outside, which some people have done, there were astronauts who went outside of the orbit and looked at the Earth. And what comes up for me and what comes up for those astronauts is that it puts them into the witness. So immediately there's a recognition of, you know, that's where I'm coming from. You know, there was some kind of evolution, biological and even spiritual. And we are the product of this process. And we stand at the end of this evolutionary process, consciously, biologically. And, you know, the British American popularizer of then, Alan Watts, said something like, the Earth is, humans are to the Earth what apples are to the apple tree. And, you know, that's something that I think Aurobindo would agree. And I would like to just think about that, because that's something that this reading or this book really brings out in me, this idea of pantheism. Okay. Let's do the meditation. So, hello. So for this reading assignment, we had to read chapter 15 and chapter 16 of Aurobindo's The Life Divine. You know, I'm just gonna go through the text. You know, I obviously did it to the best of my ability. So I'm gonna try to be as close to what's in those chapters as possible. So chapter 15, the English title is Reality and the Integral Knowledge. The German title is Wirklichkeit und das integrale Wissen. Aurobindo starts this chapter by describing the integral knowledge as a turning inwards, a return towards wholeness that can only be gained and regained by going inwards and merging and re-merging with something in us that is prior to identification. And beyond the knowledge of the inward space, there's also a knowledge of the world, the outward space. There's a higher knowledge beyond the mental. On the highest peak of the integral knowledge opens itself up to the reality of the absolute that is unspeakable and can only be known by the inner being. On the lowest end, it recognizes our unconscious evolutionary origins. It sees the one in the many, the infinite in the finite, the timeless in time, and reconciles the higher with the lower. Integral knowledge means the recognition of Brahman at once as the knowing and the unknowing, both at the same time, to gain the highest condition through becoming and unbecoming, to relate the insight of the transcendent self to the cosmic self, to arrive at the stable foundation in the transcendent and the stable manifestation of the self in the immanent. There are two possible assumptions about Brahman or the absolute. The first one being that it is empty of relationships and dispositions. The consequence being that relationships are seen as having no intrinsic reality, and that we should free ourselves from the lower forms in order to attain the absolute truth. The second view is that the absolute can be set into any descriptions or limitations. It's not bound by any relative factor. It can't be described by knowledge or unknowledge, or through being or non-being, and also not through its relationship to something or lack thereof. It gets its power through its unconditionality. It carries an unspeakable essentiality of everything that is and that can be. The actualization of the essentiality of the absolute is the manifestation of the universe. But Brahman is not just expressed in the oneness of the absolute, but also in the oneness in the manyness of cosmic beings. We ourselves must own the oneness in the infinite manyness and self-variation of the cosmos. It's the power of the free conscious soul, the free Purusha, recognizing itself in its infinity and to be capable to spread and use its energy without losing itself and getting defeated by differences and changes that try to split it up. Either way, losing itself in the infinite self-variation of the mental is still an expression of the infinite. Losing itself in the infinite separation of the mental is still an expression of the infinite. The infinite being is beyond form, so it doesn't lose its essence, becoming form. The essence remains in a material world of mountains, valleys, and bodies, which are the basis of the self-expression of the essence. The unconscious material universe contains hidden within it the timeless overconscious. To uncover this overconscious in time is the greatest conscious goal and aim of nature, according to Aurobindo. In the following pages, Aurobindo then reflects on his view on subjectivism, solipsism, constructivism, and the external world. It's a form of an epistemological struggle. So what he describes then is basically forms of unknowing, and he tries to figure out how we could come to the knowing. So he denies pure subjectivism, similar to that of Berkeley. He's stating that it covers only a partial perspective that doesn't take the whole of the mental into account. There's a mentality beyond constructs and a reality prior to constructs. There's a greater consciousness to which the mental with its constructions is only a medium of its manifestation. The mental is only an interpreter of a bigger universal reality. Its powers are only secondary and partial to the whole of reality. There is no objective reality independent of subjectivity, but objects have in its essence an independent nature in that they are not the mind's construct. The world is a play of Satchitananda, in which subjects and objects, subjective and objective realities are two sides of the same cosmos. The mental is only a mediating power in the world and a world constructor. The real creator is an energy that is inherent in the cosmic spirit. Aurobindo emphasizes further the compatibility of subjective and objective viewpoints as being two sides of the same reality, but with different claims to reality. They are independent but not reducible to each other, but they could be brought together and viewed together in an experience of totality. Integral knowledge does not only grasp the forms, but the essence behind it. So he goes on to write about the hidden knowledge in the inner and the outer worlds. And by hidden knowledge, what hidden knowledge means is the occult. The occult is the hidden knowledge. That's what that word means. In a sense, you know, according to him, we could understand, if we understand the occult as uncovering the hidden forces, science is an occult practice because it uncovers the hidden forces of nature. So then he goes on to describe how not only to uncover the hidden knowledge, but the full knowledge. And the full knowledge means an insight of the truth of all sides of being, separated by itself and in relationship to each other, as well as in relationship to the total all, to the truth of spirit. And the third step to get to this full knowledge is to recognize our unknowledge. He lists seven ways of unknowledge that separate ourselves from the unknowing. The seven ways of unknowing are, number one, our unknowledge of the absolute with its source of all being and becoming. Number two, our unknowledge of the timeless, spaceless, unmovable, and unchangeable self. Number three, our unknowledge of our universal self, of the cosmic being and consciousness. Number four, our unknowing of our eternal becoming in time. Number five, our unknowing of our enfoldment and in complex being, enfolded and complex being that is over, under, inner, and unconscious of our surroundings. Number six, our unknowledge of the true construction of the true constitution of our being. Number seven, our unknowledge of the questions of the world, the questions that the world asks us, resulting in practical failure. So the seven unknowings are, again, the primary unknowing, the cosmic unknowing, the self-centered unknowing, the unknowing of time, the psychological unknowing, the constitutional unknowing, and the practical unknowing. Integral knowledge is the suspension of those seven kinds of unknowledge. So you want to go away from this type of unknowledge through uncovering what is lacking? And correspondent to those seven types of unknowing, he lists seven resolutions to knowing. Number one, a realization of the absolute and its origins. Number two, a knowledge of the cosmic self. Number three, a knowledge of the unity of true self and world. Number four, a knowledge of our psychic being and its mortality in time. Number five, a knowledge of our bigger and inner being behind our outer self. Number six, a knowledge of mental, vital, and physical bodies in their true relationship to the supramental being beyond them. Number seven, a knowledge of true harmony and the right use of thoughts, will, and action. This is not an intellectual knowledge, but can only be acquired through experience, development, and an inner evolution.
Bravo, Tony. That was good.
Yes, yes, yes. It was a little bit long. I couldn't make it any shorter. So
it was amazing.
It's such a dense text.
Thank you, amazing summary. I'm floored.
Yes. So we have 1 hour. Right.
I'm wondering what the German is for unknowing and knowing, or knowledge and unknowledge.
Unwissen, unwissen.
Okay. So when we say ignorance, at least in our translation, does that translate the same as German, or is that?
You know, I have the German text and I just translated it into English. And, you know, it's free on the internet, but I just translated it straightforward into English.
Because that provides a different way of knowing the ignorance.
Yes, perhaps.
Or at least opens up the global picture.
Yes. Sometimes there is a big problem with the translations, because sometimes when you make the translations, they not always are able to convey completely the original meaning of the text. I mean, not only in Life Divine, but also in Savitri, for example. There is even worse. And there are people, I don't know French, but there are people who say that the translation, Mother made the translation of Savitri, and French, who know English, say it still has not the same power as reading it in English, despite the fact that she was making the translation. So, well, okay, that's here you are, all Americans, and it's your mother tongue. But I prefer to, as far as I can, my limited language notion, I prefer to read it in the original text, because there are also some words that are almost not translatable, like how do you say Geist in German can have several meaning, no? It can have meaning
spirit and mind together.
Spirit and mind. Whereas in Sri Aurobindo, spirit and mind are very two distinct things. But if you translate it with Geist, you have a real problem. There can be a great danger to misinterpret it. But language is language. It's so.
Let's talk about the integral knowledge and the aim of life. And not the integral knowledge and the aim of life, the integral knowledge.
So I just wanted to comment on this chapter 15. I actually had a lot of fun with it, because it goes into this sort of description of all the different partial views of the the spiritual life, and I found this sort of almost this list of partial views to be a kind of a really interesting way of working through a whole bunch of different issues around how you understand these things. And I quite enjoyed reading all that. I made notes to myself, and I've marked pages to come back to at a later time, just because I found it a very kind of quite clear, actually, in terms of the way he, I don't necessarily agree with all of what he says. In particular, I found his discussion of the more scientific objective side to be a little bit naive to, in some ways, but the rest of it I thought was very, very clear and very good. Another thing I wanted to say about your summary, Tony, is that one of the difficulties I have when I read Aurobindo is that, like, there's a thing in physics where if you look at too small a piece of the universe, you don't see curvature and things like, you know, everything seems to be flat. Or this idea that if you look at an elephant in the microscopic thing, you can never tell what part of the elephant you're looking at. You need to pull back in order to see more of the elephant in order to figure out where you are on the elephant. And I have the same problem with Aurobindo when I read him. It's so detailed on the micro level that it's hard to pull back and get a sense of the globality of what he's talking about. And the summary that you just gave us gave me a little bit of that feeling of the larger framework, because you summarize the micro details in such a way that we see the larger picture coming through the text. And so it's highly appreciated, this kind of way of reading the text. I'm kind of bowled over by it. So
does anybody, just a quick question, does anyone use Dave Hutchinson's outline while reading? Yeah, only you, Marco? Has anyone looked at Dave Hutchinson? Okay, good.
I looked at it, but it seemed, I found it kind of almost too obvious. Like when I read that, you know, I read the chapter and I look at his stuff and I say, yeah, well, that was kind of obvious. It didn't really take me any place that I couldn't figure out on my own, because it's almost too short.
It is.
If it was more detailed, I think it would give something that would be more useful. But that's my feeling about it.
I listened to the audio of Rand Hicks that was posted on the forum. It was very useful.
Is that listed by chapter, so you can go specifically grab the audio for chapter 15?
Yes. Have you seen it? This audio recording by Rand Hicks?
Yeah, I listened to them live. I've never actually gone and listened to the recording ones.
Okay.
I like how you started with the idea of, I can't remember the word you used, maybe detachment or just being able to take oneself outside of the earth and see the picture of the globe. I think that was a helpful position to take in the meditation. It's almost a reflection of what Jeffrey was saying. You did the same thing in your summary and allowed us to be an outside observer, to reflect upon what is presented to us here. Now, I'm having trouble jumping back in and focusing on a certain aspect of this chapter just because it is so dense, but I'd like to hear what other people have to say.
Number 7, true harmony. not an intellectual knowledge. That's what I jotted down. Earlier in the day, while I was reading the following chapter, I think it applies to this one too. I'm reading a quote from Aurobindo from something he wrote called On Himself. And this is from a book, A.S. Dalal, from Aurobindo. Large quotations from this text and from other texts, but I thought this one was particularly helpful because it's a real first person description of nirvana. This is a quote: "To reach nirvana was the first radical result of my own yoga. It threw me suddenly into a condition above and without thought, unstained by any mental or vital movement. There was no ego, no real world. Only when one looked through the immobile senses, something perceived or bore upon its sheer silence a world of empty forms, materialized shadows without true substance. There was no one or many even, only just absolutely that, featureless, relationless, sheer, indescribable, unthinkable, absolute, yet supremely real and solely real. This was no mental realization or something glimpsed somewhere above, no abstraction. It was positive, the only positive reality, although not a spatial physical world, pervading, occupying, or rather flooding and drowning the semblance of a physical world, leaving no room or space for any reality but itself, although nothing else to seem at all actual, allowing nothing else to seem at all actual, positive or substantial." And then the editor makes this remark upon this quotation. He says, "The illusoriness of the ego and the unreality of the world mentioned in the experience just described are well-known philosophical concepts associated chiefly with Buddhism and Vedanta. Here, however, the non-existence of the ego and the unreality of the world are not stated as abstract philosophical concepts, but as a direct experience, devoid of any thought or mental movement. Herein lies the first fundamental characteristic of yogic knowledge. It is based on experience, not on thought or reasoning." So I thought that was very helpful for me, because I'm a very perceptual type of person, and this first-person description almost sounds like notes that he was taking based upon his memory of these initial experiences that he had in prison. And of course, like divine all has emerged out of that direct experience. So that's a good way of me of work for me of working with this text. I don't know about other people, but this text can, because it's the nature of philosophy to go to third person and to go into definitions of definitions of definitions. And, this is what Hegel thought, this is what Kant thought, this is what Plato thought, and this is what this author thinks about Plato and Kant and Hegel. I mean, we're so used to reading philosophy in such sometimes abstract ways that it's easy to get disconnected from the direct experience. And the challenge for me, when he uses words like absolute, and I think he's pretty consistent, but I have to reread him because he may be using the same words differently, just as he uses the same metaphors differently. I think that it's I feel like this text is kind of a reverse engineering process. So he's sort of like going back into his own experience, and having had that experience, he's abstracting from it certain features that make sense in a philosophical kind of text like this. But I think it's good to sort of try to get underneath and a little bit beyond these third person abstractions to really make this come alive. Because everyone else is going to be attracted to something different in the text, and that may change as I reread this. So thanks again, Tony, for the great summary and for this opportunity.
He's a philosophical yogi, right? He has a philosophical yoga in a sense. Yes, I think that this higher harmony, you know, the first thing that I think about is obviously music. It's dance. It's something that just naturally comes forth when people are in tune with the world. And like this spiritual experience that you're describing. So I think that one thing that he does is, obviously he has this vision of the ascension into the supramental, and he lines up the whole world into this ascending force. And what he does in this epistemological struggle about, you know, this is how far your subjective constructs go, is, you know, he has this bigger vision, and he obviously knows that there's something that goes beyond that, and he read all the philosophical classics on that. You know, I always found it fascinating that someone seriously could think about let's say solipsism or something like this as, you know, something that you could defend, or like those weird philosophical positions. You know, I certainly had the same ideas. I mean, how far do my constructs go? How far is the world just a construct of words and conceptions, and what goes beyond it? I think you know, in his model, so obviously the next step is the supramental, but it's very difficult to get to this. And there are not many people who take anything beyond the mental seriously. So there are a lot of people who would say it's not there. I mean, I think it's there. You can get to this from different point of views. Many people have written about this without calling it the supramental. I think his motivation is, as was mentioned, that he had this experience in jail or whenever, and he tries to figure out how he tries to construct a way to move aside all the unknowing, and to denot all those philosophical concepts to make room for this ascension. That's, I think, what he does here.
John, what you read, was this the description of his experience of nirvana, or what was it? Okay, thanks.
That's what he called it. And I think it's very helpful. I wish more yogis and commentators on altered states of consciousness gave such detailed first person descriptions of the actual experience, because a lot of people just use code words or use words like nirvana, and then we go off into to a complex theory. But many people use nirvana in very different ways. And I think it becomes a very slippery slope very fast, because as he mentions, this is beyond words. So words become increasingly crude as we try to describe something so ineffable. But I think that's why, for me, it's much more easy to follow if I just treat it like poetry, than a kind of logical argument that he's proposing. So I use the word reverse engineering because maybe that's not quite the right word, but I sort of want to find under the philosophical vocabulary some direct experience that I can resonate with, because I think that's where something starts to get integrated. Because I'm sure we've had lots of experiences of altered states here, and we've had lots of experiences that we've had that are very formal, sitting in meditation, but then there are a lot of other experiences that we've had we don't have an adequate language for. But that shapes us and influences very, very profoundly. And maybe why we run to all these difficult philosophical texts, because we're looking for someone who's put it together for us, these experiences, and found a meaning that maybe we missed. Because sometimes these experiences are very, very subtle, and sometimes they're extremely dramatic, and you don't know what to do with them.
What page was that on, John? In the Greater Psychology, right?
Yeah, it's Greater Psychology. It's page... hold on a second. If you'll be patient with me, I'll find it. Strange. It must be 301, because there's no. It's part two, Essays on Sri Aurobindo's Thought. It's the first chapter of part two, The Nature and Methodology of Yoga Psychology. Oh, yeah, it's 303. But I also wanted to, I liked your image too of the planet, and your question about, I think was well posed, about Aurobindo, and he may not have seen those photos because he died. What did he die in? 48? Right after the war, really.
Well, I think 50. He hasn't.
It was 1950?
Yes, December.
By the time he wrote it, he hasn't seen it.
Right. He had already died, because I don't think we landed on the moon till 64, wasn't it? And then we had all those dramatic photos coming out shortly afterwards, where I think people did get a visceral sense of this emerging planetary consciousness. So I also have a question about construct-aware persons who read this text, and I get a feeling that most of us are construct aware at the very least, maybe way beyond that. But most of us have some background in developmental psychology, and we all have been exposed to this sort of planetary kind of aesthetic. And I think Aurobindo was writing before this had really started, but I think he was picking up on it way in advance of its actual collective sort of appearance. So I'm just curious about, you know, some people are talking about post-spirituality, and there are like Gibbs would say, deficient forms of spirituality that are expressed in like fundamentalism of all kinds, which leads to violence and rigid dogmatisms, and that we may be confronting this deficient forms of spirituality around the globe as a post-spiritual kind of spirituality might become emergent. Probably, I would think, driven by a lot of construct-aware kind of sensibilities. But this is highly speculative on my part. I'm just wondering if he was working with that kind of an audience. The kind of audience that was reading him then, I doubt there were a lot of construct-aware types as there are now. For those of us who follow that kind of, you know, vocabulary. So I may be fast-forwarding it to something else. So thanks anyway.
I think we have a tendency to underestimate people living in the past, living 100 years ago. I'm always surprised, you know, reading someone like Aurobindo who lived 100 years ago, who is as fresh and as, you know, seems to be as present as, or more present than most people now. And there are many people like that. I mean, you can read some, I don't know, 19th century sociologist or so, and just feels as alive as today.
Absolutely. And I wasn't saying that about Aurobindo. I'm just saying about the audiences that he was writing for.
Yes, I think, well, you know,
I'm just saying he must have been very, very alone in some ways, because he's bringing forward something that was pretty rare then and pretty rare now. But I'm just wondering about how he had these radical experiences, such as he described in the prison, these nirvanic experiences that probably many of us have had if you've done any meditation practice. But it's how you mature those experiences into like a life-sustaining kind of philosophy. How you pull that off, I think, is the challenge that he gave himself. And I think he went through the traditions that he was familiar with and pulled out the stories and the metaphors that were most compelling, so that he could make something that other people could, that was the communication to others. So I think this is a grand effort at trying to communicate something that's probably pretty impossible to communicate. But he did a good job, for sure.
I think, at least I'm thinking of...
Oh, I'm sorry, Dave.
Go, if you have a question, go ahead.
No, just a quick statement. I would just say Life Divine is his answer to the question why, but almost all of his other writing is process and practice and practical advice to get the sadhak by the quickest path possible to these states that he describes in detail in other places. It's just Life Divine isn't, it's a small fraction of the work, and most of his writing is dedicated to helping those along. It's especially Letters on Yoga, but Letters on Yoga is now 1,500 pages or longer. So, yeah, he was definitely wanting to help us.
It's been maybe almost 100 years since he had these ideas, and he's forming an internal globe or a sphere, so to speak. We read Sloterdijk, some of us here, and he made the statement that once maps were developed of the globe and we started to explicate the various surfaces of the globe, that what could have, at least what I'm saying now, I don't think these are Sloterdijk's words, but what could have happened was a more outsider view, but we humans took the conquering point of view rather than, well, what can we do to make this a planetary situation? But it turned out to be a global conquering and wars, and I mean, of course there's peace in between, but and in a certain sense the same thing is happening with the stars, with the moon and Mars. It's a conquering mentality. It's a desire to take our current human capitalistic type of thinking and project it into the cosmos now. But what Aurobindo is doing is internal. His cosmos are vaster than anything we can imagine, which he's taking from philosophies and ideas of the past into this integral knowledge and really allowing us to explicate our internal experience, even though as the individual, that's a very tough thing to do because it's not a tangible, at least not to our eyes. It's not as tangible as, say, the screen in front of us right now. So what he has done for us is help us see the path towards this occult internal world.
He's in a sense the Hegel of the East, you know, someone has called him that. And he has the biggest vision possible, and he really tries to make sense of everything, having lived in the East and the West and thinking those both together. That's very admirable. That's just a very noble pursuit. Something that I think, if I'm like very honest to myself, like this is the absolute right thing to do. You should do this, should figure out the whole, but I'm not smart enough, you know? And some people maybe are, and Otto Bindo, you know, he's obviously exceptionally smart, and you know, to take on this mental task of figuring East and West out and doing this in an internal way, I think is very admirable.
So Matsuo, you mentioned the letters on yoga, and I think it was Maxwell Massey or Tony the last time who brought up that those volumes as being, yeah, Marco, as being perhaps a somewhat more readable, accessible text in relation to Aurobindo. But Matsuo, you mentioned that there are thousands of pages of it. And when I looked it up online, it looked like it was in several volumes. So I sort of wondered how many volumes one had to read in order to get, you know, I mean, if there's like a, because somebody was asking me about if I could recommend them a book about Aurobindo. And I said, well, maybe not The Life Divine, but I didn't know what else to suggest. So I talked about the letters, but based on your recommendations the last time. So.
I think Marco just held up volume 2. That's the perfect volume to recommend because it contains foundations of sadhana, the basic requisites of the path, the yoga of love, the yoga of devotion, the yoga of karma yoga, the yoga of work, jnana yoga, the yoga of knowledge. It contains, the volume 2 is probably it. But like, not to neglect any of the other volumes, the new volume 4 has a whole section on yogic experiences. And I have to be careful talking about volumes because there's different books within those. Mm-hmm. And there's and the old volumes that I have, the organization, it might be different than what Marco has.
Let's go to the next chapter.
May I add only quickly to what he said, Amanda? Yes, this is the old edition, and there's also a new edition, which comprises also the letters, which has been discovered later after his departure, also much later. So actually, it's a lot of stuff, and I would not suggest to begin with that. Mm. But it is a nice place where you can browse through. You must not necessarily go from page 1 to the last page. You go browse through as through some specific and you read.
You're really challenging Jeffrey, Marco. He has to start from volume 1, page 1.
Then it's very hard.
What I was quoting from is from a text called On Himself, page 101, 102.
That's Sorry,
sounds autobiographical. Sounds like
On himself is a collection of letters also. That's why I say there's thousands of pages. The volume of called The Mother, the mother is very short. It's like 28 pages or 30 pages. The rest of it's letters on the mother. Most of his writing post 1926, I mean, almost all of his writing post 1926, there's Savitri, and then there's the supermental manifestation on Earth, but the rest is the thousands of pages of letters, and they're in various volumes that probably compile 2,000, maybe 2,500 pages.
Let's go to the next chapter. Chapter 16 of The Life Divine. The integral knowledge and the aim of life, four theories of existence. The German title is Das integrale Wissen und das Ziel des Lebens, vier Theorien des Daseins. So in the first 10 pages, he repeats himself a lot and he builds up his cosmic view and he builds up to his four theories of existence. Four theories of existence, and those four theories are the supercosmic view, the cosmic and earthly view, three, the heavenly and extramundane or otherworldly view, four, the integral and synthetic and harmonizing view. So the supercosmic view is one that divides the world up in an absolute and a relative. So the absolute can be called Brahman, the relative can be called Atman, or it splits the world up between an infinite and a finite, and an substantial and an unsubstantial one. There's a clear value statement there that one is less real and important and the other is more real and important. And it's in its extreme form, one would say that all relative appearance is unimportant. It's very close to the Buddhist view of nirvana that can be attained through extinction of the self. So in the extreme forms, one would just extinct oneself and just let the absolute be. So that's the supra-cosmic view. The second, the cosmic and earthly view, that's basically like some form of deistic materialism. So in many ways, it's actually the opposite of the first one, which is the supra-cosmic view. In the earthly view, material matter is real and the only reality. And only material matter is real, and the world is seen as a material process of becoming. The only true reality are the material forms. There's no soul or believable form of afterlife. Meaning is found only in this life. Meaningful goals can be extended to a whole race, like all of humanity or like the nation, and to one's own life, and to one's own lifespan. And, you know, in the extreme forms, one would just make the best of one's own life. So that's the second earthly view. The third view is the heavenly or otherworldly view. It's a view that would ascend the material realm and postulate another world. So there's another world. It's like the typical Christian view. Christian view with the heaven and the hell, and you have to do good deeds, and if you do bad deeds, you obviously come into this other world, which is like hell or heaven or whatever, but it's not this world, it's another world. It postulates a soul and an immortality and an afterlife. And there are versions in the East that I liked it, like the Divine Play of Leela. There, so in the Divine Play of Leela, there are reincarnations that the soul participates in order to ascend to the godly or heavenly realm. So, but in this lifetime, from lifetime to lifetime. So there's always a spirit of ethical process and like ethical development in this otherworldly view. And then he finishes this up by integrating those three views, the supra-cosmic, the immanent, and the otherworldly view. He finishes up by synthesizing and harmonizing those views. And it's a very unique unique vision. So at least this the commentator, Rand Hicks, said that it's so super unique. He starts by naming the problem. So, quote, "The human life appears to be vain. The cosmic existence is unreal. The earth is full of bitterness and ugliness and cruelty. Even the heavens aren't any compensation. And the reincarnation from body to body is meaningless. So the ordinary person stays dissatisfied with the situation. The extraordinary person, according to Aurobindo, tries to synthesize those into a higher solution. To get to a resolution of those opposing views, we need to realign the lower consciousness into a higher frequency and to ultimately spiritualize matter, as he puts it. Further, he goes through those three views as outlines and reconciles them, starting with the cosmic and earthly view that is governed by physical processes and the mental. He claims that while the mental is extremely useful and has gained a lot of ground in bettering our human conditions through science and whatever, but it lets the mental unsatisfied. And it's unsatisfied because the mental is just a partial expression of its capacities. To find a higher fulfillment, to find a higher perspective, we have to open up to a spiritual consciousness beyond the mental, a consciousness that is universal and that ascends the material, vital, mental forms into the light of a higher consciousness that is the natural evolutionary progression, according to Aurobindo. So then he goes on and he reunites or harmonizes the supra-cosmic view, as he calls it. And so there's an integration of the absolute and the universal nature. So it's not just a fleeing into some absolute realm, but we want to live here on Earth. So normally, given this view, one would aim to transcend the body and get into the highest transcendent realm while dismissing the body or even the world altogether. In this unifying view, both the infinite and the finite is part of one process of becoming that doesn't stay in opposition to each other, and which goal is to find a unity in the transcendent, in the universal, and in the individual in order to achieve a greater fulfillment and a greater being. So then he goes on and reunites the heavenly realm. And so this view postulates that the soul goes to a different place of existence, and the soul is important to examine. So the goal of this is to get into the afterlife and to another world. But for him, the goal is to stay in this world and live a divine life in this world, and to see the world as a stage in which the soul, the soul's goal is to ascend. So one could say that his overall process is one that balances those ways of knowing and being, and to enact the hidden involutionary potentials in an evolution that goes from the unconscious to the half-conscious, to the overconscious, and to express spirit in an unveiled greater light through that process. That chapter, summarizing the chapter, was actually much easier. So I read it and I got it the first time, actually. So I thought that chapter was easier to get than the previous one.
Yes, it was maybe easier, but I think you have made an even better summary. Also, the previous one was made very well, but this was even better, I think, because I think if someone who is seeing this video online and doesn't know nothing about Sri Aurobindo and hears what you have said, I think most get it, what it is about. And it is interesting because especially this point that you said, the opposing views that he brings together, things that seemingly are opposing views for if we look at them from the mental level. But here you have a synthesis of things that sometimes people fight each other because they sustain one or the other view. And what I like very much here in this chapter and also in your summary is how it becomes clear that these are only apparent contradictions. And it makes clear how also mind works. Mind sees, oh, the truth must be here or the truth must be there. And it has a great difficulties to bring them together into unique vision. And here Sri Aurobindo, I think, puts together heaven and hell, as you have said, and much more. The infinite and the finite. And the supracosmic, the cosmic, the earthly, all as a manifestation of the one. When I read this for the first time, I said, that resonated with me 100%. And you have put it very well. You have made a very interesting summary. I hope others looking at this video will go through it and listen to it because it gets to the point, I think, or one of the points of Sri Aurobindo's, I don't like to call it philosophy because I don't think it's philosophy, but well, let's put it in that way.
I found myself agreeing with him very much that bringing this together and rebalancing the tradition which he finds himself in. I found myself agreeing a lot, like, yes, that's how one should do it.
Yeah, you say balancing traditions. I think also this is very important, especially in these times where there are so many conflicts and we tend to see, everyone sees only one part of the truth. We live, I think, generally, nowadays we live in a time where of extremes, you know, where everyone sees one part of the truth and thinks that this is the whole truth. Whereas here we have an example of thinking otherwise. We should also see where the others can have catched some part of the truth that I didn't. And it is an interesting exercise to see how to integrate, to bring together in an integral view, as Sri Aurobindo would say, all the different opinions have the core of truth. And if you are able to go not to a higher, it doesn't need a higher consciousness, but from a higher point of view, you see them all with all the contradictions, they make sense suddenly.
And he's not dismissive. He actually goes into each one of those and tries to find out what is valuable and how to bring it forth. And in a sense, we live in the same cosmos. I mean, the material world, kind of this absolute Eastern philosophy, and the otherworldly, maybe Christian view, but there are different branches of it in every tradition. And we have to find our way and find our own synthesis. And yes.
Absolutely. Yeah.
I have some thoughts or some things I noticed in the text that stood out to me. It might be a contribution to the conversation. The first is the way that Aurobindo defines the word integral, and defines integral knowledge. This is salient for me because I encountered Aurobindo through Wilbur, and so through Wilbur I have a framework that in a lot of its features, I think would maps very well to Aurobindo's text, in the sense that it kind of summarizes some of the thinking that's here, the integral framework or the integral view that puts together the truths from multiple perspectives into a more whole and a more holistic kind of perspective. Like that move is in Wilbur, but it's here in a different way. And I think that there's the first paragraph of the earlier chapter, chapter 15, says it well, and I starred this and underlined it. So what is integral knowledge, right? There must be a replacement of a limited and separative by an essential and integral consciousness identified with the original truth and the whole truth of self and existence. The integral knowledge is something that is already there in the integral reality. It is not a new or still non-existing thing that has to be created, acquired, learned, invented, or built up by the mind. It must rather be discovered or uncovered. It is a truth that is self-revealed to a spiritual endeavor, for it is there veiled in our deeper and greater self. It is the very stuff of our own spiritual consciousness, and it is by awaking to it, even in our surface self, that we have to possess it. And I thought that was interesting. It's an interesting contrast to some ways that the integral idea is articulated, even in Gebser for that matter. This is not just a compare and contrast with Wilbur, but in Gebser, the integral is a mutation. It comes into being through a non-linear kind of historical process of consciousness. But it's not necessarily in being before it comes into being. Or in Gebser, it's latent, but not yet apparent. That might be one other way of looking at it. I think in Wilbur, at least in his philosophical framework, the integral it is a something that is built up by the mind. It's built by comparing and contrasting different perspectives and coming up with orienting generalizations. This is how Wilbur describes his own method. Orienting generalizations that include the essentials of all of those respective points of view. And so you get at a kind of summary view that you're able to use as a, I guess, to gain leverage over the different kind of phenomena that show up to those different views. But this is different in the way that I think reflects not a construct, but a reality. I'm reminded that John brought up the idea of construct aware earlier. And I think that this is beyond construct aware because it involves direct perception or direct intuition or a term I'm working with, identity, knowledge by identity. And so identity with what is reality, is the integral reality, the whole thing. I really like these chapters, and I like that we're in this twist of the book, because we've come, I think, out of that examination of ignorance and all and conditioning, the kind of what he in these chapters refers to as the lower hemispheres. The lower hemisphere with mind, life, matter, and the ignorance. And now he's just giving his view of what is real, what is truly true. This is the full presentation of it. And everything to this point in my reading so far has been preparation for the download. So what I've been working with has been a few different terms. One is mentality, the mind, what the mind does in constructing and creating concepts and articulating a view. Two is perception, or what I've been thinking about in terms of direct perception. I know that that's not the only way of knowing that Aurobindo articulates, or he has four different ways of knowing: the direct perception, the direct but separate, and then by identity, and then the other one was separate and by description. But the direct perception, and is it, how can, if Aurobindo, here's the question, if Aurobindo is describing reality, then it can't be something that's inaccessible. It has to be what's immediately accessible. It has to be what's directly perceivable, not just thinkable. The mentation of it is a different matter. We may not be able to adequately express what the reality is. We may not find the words, or the words may require poetry or may require some other kind of communication, but it should be directly accessible and directly available to experience. However, because it is the reality that is true at any time, prior to time, in any space, prior to space, even in ignorance, ignorance is a derivation of the reality, then one shouldn't need a special experience in order to experience it. It shouldn't just be available in nirvana or in a lucid dream or in a psychedelic trip or in deep meditation, whatever it is, it should be accessible at any time in any manifestation. So that, I think, is, I'm just describing kind of my meditation process with these chapters. And I think what's profound about it is that, John has said this as well, like, we don't need anything else. We don't need, everything that we would need would be available in that view of things and in that experience of things. Like, even right now, in this moment that we're sharing on this call, And that to me has a very different flavor, I guess, of what integral would mean, or what the aim of a spiritual path would be. This is where the second chapter picks up. Because the point in the second chapter that Aurobindo is making is that your view of your understanding of what's real should determine how you live your life, what you view, how you conduct your life, the aim of your life, the purpose of your life. So if your view and understanding of reality is this integral one, then what would that mean about the way that you, the way that, that you live? And to me, this is like an answer. Like, this is the answer to the question, because he's saying that the world would not exist. Like, the phenomenal world that we experience, and including ourselves, including the whole cosmos, would not exist for just so that we could wake up out of it or escape it. It doesn't make sense, is what he's saying. Moreover, in that integral experience, there's a purpose for the manifestation. And the purpose is that it's the expression of the one reality. It's its own self-fulfillment, its self-expression, its self-delight. It's its way of being and becoming. So getting out of it defeats the purpose. It's either wrong, or it's just only a partial answer. And the integral knowledge, or the integral path or yoga, would be fulfilling the purpose of the cosmos and of the absolute or the Brahman or whatever you call it, but through one's actual life, through the divinization of one's life and of one's relations, and I think ultimately he's saying the divinization of matter, which is I don't think it's so far-fetched. I mean, I think it sounds mystical or something, but I mean, we can imagine very simple examples of what the divinization of matter would mean. Like a meal cooked with love, a meal that's nutritious and healthy and delicious and given freely. That could be the divinization of matter, for example. So I really appreciate the summaries, because I think that he's, and I know there were a lot of work, and I think two summaries in one week is probably too much for, I mean, unless you really want to really hardcore double down, but maybe others could, if there's two chapters in a week, we could share one person pick up one chapter each, or we could split up the weeks. That we can come back to that later. So I mean, this to me really comes back to a focus on how we do things, because I think that's like, if there isn't a purpose in the afterlife, or if escaping manifestation into the void isn't the answer to the big question of life, the universe, and everything, then what is it? It has to be in the manifestation itself. It has to be through the divinization of that. And that is in how we live. That's how we conduct ourselves, and how really we affect everything, right? Our whole world would look different if we made it that way, I suppose, if it came through us in that way. So that I think is the great work. I mean, that's what I see with like the Aurobindians doing, and the intuit, like we're trying to get there where we can actually change things, I think, make them more apparently divine. But anyway, I'm going to trail off there. I think that's what I wanted to share. And I was glad to just be able to listen for the first half of this as well. And I probably will. I hope I can do the same for the rest.
I think that he maybe is a little bit less mental than Wilbur, but what I get from him is that, I mean, he does live in this higher planes, in this integral planes. But what he gives gives us, or what he gives me, is a greater existential language for this. You know, there's a, he's also very much into concepts, but you can anchor maybe your own integral vision or your own higher vision in this existential language that he gives one. And it's a language of greater clarity and the chaos, and it does come from a higher kind of perception that sees a higher harmony and wants that higher harmony. And yes, I'm very grateful for this existential language. You know, it's also for oneself, I think, if you want to manifest this in your life, you need to orient yourself somehow in concepts. It is beyond concepts. But, you know, having something like this, like the divine life, I think people probably do read this as kind of a mantra almost. I mean, what was his name? Like reading this for 40 years, over and over, you get this language, and it really does help you live from a divine place, which is probably the goal of his vision.
That was really beautiful, Marco. Forgetting about the life divine for a minute and just talking about a question that I have always struggled answering and talking about with people is, what is integral yoga? What is the integral yoga of Sri Aurobindo and the Mother? And the point that you made about cooking food, it's like the... it's the kind of the aspiration of life is in integral yoga is to make everything sacred, including ourselves, to be completely consecrated to the divine with the aspiration that there eventually those veils may be pierced and there may be no difference between us and the divine. There's full unity there, and there's lots of ways and processes that Mother and Sri Aurobindo left us in their writings that seem like, you know, they do seem like shortcuts in that process. And I would describe processes as aspiration, discernment, and surrender, and faith, and sincerity, practicing peace and goodness and generosity as higher states of being, and not just aspiration, but receptivity and the courage to progress. You know, all these things are like the foundational base of integral yoga, with patience in expanding out the human ranges of consciousness, the seemingly impossible, but it's like, I know it's not impossible, aspiration of collaborating with the divine in these processes, building a bridge between, aspiring to be an instrument for the divine, and building connectivity between mind, life, body, and the infinite soul, realizing, resolving seeming dualities, not as like success and failure, but these two things as like subsets of each other, one, both existing underneath the umbrella of the infinite, the free will and choice to consecrate and surrender to the all will. And a lot of these mental discourse things just kind of fall away when working in that integrative way. I don't always have the right words for it. But the food example to me is just so beautiful because it's like, it's concrete and it's loving. It's, and I say concrete in the way that it's like, it's got that, like, how do I make this sacred? How do I make this communication sacred? How do I make my life sacred and my home sacred and all the organizations with which we're working, business, spiritual, whatever. Like there's no, in this way, the whole planet is an ashram. There's no ashram because there's no ashram to escape to. There's no place to go. There's no nirvana to, there's no extinguishment to seek. Nirvana is just a passing state and a realization, even if it's just a glimpse on the way to the realization of the passive Brahman. And yeah, I don't know, life divine for me reading it. These two chapters are so beautiful. They are so Upanishadic. The Isha just shines through and through in all of these pages. The passage that you read when he talks about the lid, there's a mantra in the Isha Upanishad that's so beautiful for practicing. It's the face of truth is covered by a brilliant golden lid. That do thou remove, O fosterer, for the law of truth, for sight. Vision is such a thing with Sri Aurobindo. It's like truth of vision is right there in front all the time. Truth of hearing, truth of the soul coming out in all this instrument, in all this instrumentality. These chapters are so beautiful. They made me smile. And there's some humor in it too. There's one place where he starts talking about crazy and the madhouse and overcoming our insanity. And a couple of places where his humor really comes through. Anyway, and thank you, Tony, for those wonderful detailed summaries. I know that those are not easy to do. I know how I can see how much time you spent. I appreciate it.
I wanted to say something about so Marco, you were talking about the divinization of life and the way that Aurobindo talks about, you know, not escaping to, I mean, in Christian terms, it's kind of the afterlife, but obviously this is a cross-religious perspective. And to somebody like me, with my understanding of the world and the life that we live, you know, the idea that you would want to leave this life to go to a different, regardless, a different plane, or, you know, is sounds almost ludicrous, but I have known people in my life who had precisely that idea in their minds. And in particular, to speak about somebody much closer to home than that, my mother may have accelerated her own death because she saw herself as essentially wasting her time here on earth and wanted to move on to the next, you know, and she was aware that that wasn't necessarily what anybody was suggesting, but that was certainly part of the thinking that she was going through. And so the fact that Aurobindo drives home this point that this is not about living your life on a higher plane outside of the world that we live in, that this is bringing the divine into the world that we live rather than, anyway, it just, because I have a personal association with that idea, you know, I kind of wish I'd read this book when I was discussing these things with my mother, because I think I would have had a stronger set of arguments to be able to, not that it might not have made any difference to what happened anyway, but I do feel that the arguments that he makes about this particular issue are compelling and precious, I guess.
Again, I don't like leaving early. I just have a 7 p.m. meeting that I need to scoot to. So thank you, everybody. I appreciate it. See you all in 2 weeks. Oh, no, I'm see you all next week. Yeah.
Thank you.
Yeah, bye-bye.
Ciao, Matteo.
Ciao. Juice.
I have a few comments and responses, and they're not very well thought out, but when I mentioned construct aware, I was not talking about Sri Aurobindo. I think he's beyond construct aware. I think he's definitely exploring subtle levels of mind at the level of unity. But I think he, who is writing for people, who I don't think were primarily construct aware. I think they were in the mythic and maybe very deficient forms of the mythic. So I think that's what I was addressing in my previous comments. But I believe probably the majority of the people on the planet right now are in the mythic and a negative or deficient forms of the mythic. But I think there are many more of us who are construct aware, and there may be more of us who have had unifying experiences. But I'm also, when you say the one, I don't think one is a number. He's talking about unity, because I think it's very confusing. As we construct aware postmodern types who've gone through the sexual revolution, the environmental crisis that we're going through now, the ecology movement, the women's movement, the gay movement, all these different kinds of the civil rights movement, all of these various movements have changed our world very dramatically. And this was all happened after Aurobindo's work had happened. So I'm just saying that the challenges that we have are very similar, but I think very different. And I think he was writing for us. I think we are, he was writing for his time and the audiences that he was writing for, which I think, as I mentioned earlier, I don't think they were construct aware primarily, but I think that he was also writing for us. And I think we're really privileged to be putting down this new foundation for this next wave, this mutation of consciousness. But I just want to say something that A.H. Almas once said. He's a teacher from... he's a contemporary spiritual teacher, but he said it's much harder, or he said it's much easier to study subtle levels of mind than it is to go out and get a job. And I, he was speaking, I read this comment of his maybe 10 years ago. I think it's even harder now. but I think we're in the grips of not a planetary future. That's still a possibility for us. I think we're in the grips of a global kind of neoliberal capitalist takeover. And I think that it's a very different kind of challenge, an unprecedented one in some ways. But I do think it's very heartening that for his otherworldliness, because he did study in great depth these subtle levels of mind, and he mapped them out, and he wrote about them so eloquently. And that's of great benefit to all of us. But I also think there was a, he was very involved in geopolitics, and he was taken surprise by the rise of fascism and Hitler. He changed his views on Indian nationalism. He actually thought that they should make a deal with the British crown after the war, because he thought Stalin and Russia was a much bigger threat than Hitler was. And he didn't want the partition to happen with Pakistan. So he was against the politics that Gandhi wanted. And I think the results are that that we have a different world now than would have happened, I think, if Aurobindo had had his desires for the global politics of his time had occurred, and which he worked hard for. So those are the aspects of Aurobindo that I think are very curious, that he was able to blend this otherworldly with this very this-worldly kind of dynamic. And to me, his descriptions in this particular chapter, which you outlined so well, Tony, I think sounds to me like he's doing some parts work, a little bit of gestalt, being able to go between these different sub-personalities, what we would call now sub-personalities, and find a new kind of blend. And he seemed to be very comfortable with the holding the paradoxical nature of going in between and exploring the boundary conditions. And I feel that a lot more people can do this now. I don't think it's that far-fetched for most of us to be able to go inside and locate a sub-personality and hold the paradox and allow energetically stuff to shift. So I think that we have a lot of resources now made available to us, and perhaps in our gathering here studying this text we can deal with the intensification that is coming through, because it's getting very intense, I'm sure, for all of us. So thank you very much for this opportunity once again to explore this. Thank you.
That was one of the questions I had to what you just ended there with John, was what methods have changed since Aurobindo's time? What do we have available? Not necessarily that it's better to what we have in front of us, but in a way, this is an internet ashram. We're performing spiritual gymnastics over the web. I was thinking of the various things that have developed over the past 50, 60, 70 years since he's not been physically present. And this is almost the culmination of what is possible here. That wasn't possible in his time. He couldn't communicate with somebody in the United States except through a potential letter. And that right there is a massive change, along with any other I did review his, I don't know if his letters on yoga or record on yoga, but just I'm interested in dreaming. So I went back and looked at the dream sections of Aurobindo, and at least in his reflections, was just kind of it wasn't something like lucid dreaming. It didn't seem like he explored it much, but maybe I just missed out on it. So I feel like that's an interesting development that just lucid dreaming or dream yoga, I guess dream yoga has been around forever, but just the exploration of that internal side of us is one dynamic. But I couldn't really think of too many things off the top of my head that have the methods that have changed.
Well, in the prison, he described that nirvanic experience. He also had a visitation from, I think it was Vivekananda, who had already, a spiritual teacher had passed away. And Vivekananda gave him instructions, advanced instructions in certain yogic techniques. I think he was doing much more than just exploring nirvana. And I believe he's highly critical of the Buddhist who want to ascend, get beamed up into nirvana, form of suicide. So I think he was dealing with those ascending and descending currents, and he tried to describe it. But I think we have the additional many different kinds of descriptions that are available to us now because of the internet and other resources. And we can have direct experience of many different kinds of practices that, probably were not available to so many people, to so many more people than back then. Whereas, the mother was, I think she was a Jewish family. She lived in Paris, very bohemian lifestyle. She was married twice. She studied Zen in Japan. She ends up becoming the initiate consort for Aurobindo in the ashram. I mean, and she was a Western woman. So this sort of broke the mold of what a consort in the traditional tantric traditions was supposed to be. And there was some friction, I understand, with the ashram around her participation. So I'm just putting that out there as the idea that they may have been the first post-religious or post-religious power couple. And I think they were going in a very different direction. So I think that they were, he was trying to direct his attention to many different kinds of audiences, a future audience and the audience of his time, and bringing this otherworldly and out and this worldly aspects together. Very creative way. I hope we can all do the same.
So I noticed the time, we're past the 2 hour point, and I'm getting pretty tired. So, but I did want to say for next week, I'm still happy to do the two chapters that I originally signed up for. But on the list, there are 3 chapters assigned for next week. And I'd rather not do the third one if somebody could take that one on. It's a shorter chapter. It's about 15 pages long. So I'll do 17 and 18, and I'm looking for somebody to do 19.
What's the title of 19? I mean, I can look it up. I was just asking if you knew.
The Sevenfold Unknowing.
That's right.
I'd be able to help out with the chapter for sure.
I was going to say, if somebody's read Banerjee's book, because the Sevenfold is related, I think, to Banerjee's book, so it would be an interesting one.
I have that book.
Yeah. I have it, but I haven't read it.
I'm working on it. Are you working on this, Marco? Have you looked at it?
Yeah, I'm a couple chapters in.
Yeah, I've read two or three chapters.
I think I'll come back to it after we finish Life Divine.
Mm. Okay.
Yeah, we can. If nobody else steps up, I'll do it. But I guess you're stepping up now, Marco. Maybe.
Well, I was gonna give it 24 hours, and then nobody's on the form, and then I'll add my name. But I'm happy to just add my name right now. That helps move things along.
All right, between the two of us, we'll figure it out.
Okay. Yeah.
With that, I'm going to say good night because I'm.
Good night, all. Thank you so much.
Good night.
Good night.
Good night. Bye-bye.
And thank you so much, Tony, for all the work that you did on this.
Yeah, that was
yes, so yes, no problem. You get something out of it if you do it. You get something for yourself. I think I understand it a little bit more. And also you have some pressure to do it, you know. So that helps.
Good night, all.
Okay, so good night and have a wonderful rest of the day, whatever.
Thank you.
I don't think I can sleep and probably won't sleep tonight, but bye-bye. Ciao.
I try. Bye-bye.
Bye, everyone.